This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is Jay Stowe with the next installment of Esquire's March 2024 issue, the one with Austin Butler on the cover. We're going to jump into and finish off the How to Be a Better Man feature from last week with one final sidebar in that piece. Three style rules that never go out of fashion. Trends are for people who can't dress themselves. So take time to find a style you like and make it your own. Then build on that vision with the following principles in mind. Nick Sullivan. Emphasize versatility. Never buy anything that has only one application, except a quality tuxedo. A good top coat is often the first thing anyone will notice about you, whether it's over a suit and tie at work or paired with jeans and a sweater on the weekend. Invest in a well-cut one, either single or double-breasted. Melton wool is preferred. Plain colors like gray and navy go furthest. 2. Splurge in a smart way. Don't be afraid to spend big on something with a little extra style, but make it something you know you'll wear often. Try a classic black leather biker jacket. It will work for almost any occasion. See rule number 1. And it should last a while if you treat it well. It'll look even more expensive if it fits properly, so take your time choosing the right one. 3. Buy a brush. If you want to give them a long life, caring for your clothes is essential. You can spend a fortune sending your suits and coats to the dry cleaner, and it's not good for them. Usually, all they need is a decent workover with a stiff bristle clothes brush to remove dust or lint and realign wayward fibers. Spend more than $50 for a quality one. Next up, Ageless Armani. The Maestro's menswear is as current as it comes, but never forget the revolution it sparked when it debuted in 1975. By Nick Sullivan, photographs by Christian Hogstead, and styling by Allison Edmond. And on the opening spread, they have two photos. On the left side, there's a model standing amidst a lot of tropical plants. He is wearing a kind of a trench coat, a t-shirt, and a pair of billowy trousers. The jacket, the shirt, the trousers, and the sunglasses he's wearing are all by Giorgio Armani. The sunglasses are $1,318. And on the right page, there's another photo of the same model standing in a different location, kind of on a bridge near a beach, leaning against a large tree or cement post. It's hard to tell. But he's got a kind of a tannish brown double-breasted suit he's wearing with an ascot kind of tie, or a scarf, actually, and a little hat on, just kind of a beach hat. And it looks like a dark t-shirt of some kind. And a pair of laceless high-top running shoes that are mustardy yellow. Well, brown mustard. The jacket, trousers, hat, and scarf are by Giorgio Armani. The tank top he's wearing under the jacket is $32 for a pack of four by Jockey. And the sneakers are $270 by APL. If the latest menswear from Giorgio Armani feels familiar to you, that's proof of concept. When the Milanese designer introduced his radically reimagined interpretation of traditional tailoring in 1975, he established a design language that was both comfortable and impressively durable. Nowadays, you see it everywhere, but no one executes it quite like the maestro himself. The key in all of this softening things up while stripping them down. The key in all of this is softening things up while stripping them down. Armani's clothes are defined by movement and ease, a thoroughly contemporary idea of masculine bella figura. When they debuted, that was a far cry from the rest of the market. Though the Neapolitan tailors of the 30s had devised a way to do away with much of the stuffing in a suit jacket, the highly structured British take on construction continued to dominate the world of tailored clothing. Even designer ready-to-wear, still in its infancy in the early 70s, had a tendency toward rigidity. But Armani was all about fluidity. He pioneered the use of ever-lighter suiting fabrics, challenging the weavers of Biella, the northern Italian hub of fabric production, to come up with exclusive cloths that gave him that characteristic Armani crunch without the weight of traditional wools. These did not hang stiffly from the chest or the hips, but, with minimal internal structure, moved and flowed with the wearer, a trick emphasized with roomier jackets and wider pants. Pulling everything but the absolute essentials out of the standard suit, Armani did away with retro-inspired tailoring, creating a whole new style canon in the process. By the 1980s, the decade when a generation of young men, civilians, and celebrities alike ditched their father's tailors, Armani had become synonymous with A-lister fashion in the States, starring, alongside Richard Gere, in American Gigolo, and beaming into homes across the country on Miami Vice. And to this day, it's a go-to for influential front-row types and red carpets. During this year's awards season, for instance, Armani was responsible for some of the best-dressed men at the ceremonies, including Leonardo DiCaprio, Jeremy Allen White, and Charles Melton. The only major shift in the intervening years happened not within Armani, but around the label, as upstart fashion brands and established mass retailers adopted the same approach to deconstructed comfort. You can now find a soft suit, slouchy jacket, or voluminous trouser everywhere, from the bougiest boutique to the local mall. Still, there's nothing quite like the original. And true to Armani form, the summer 2024 collection plays with flowing cloths and a palette of natural colors like taupe, tobacco, and stone. Roomy summer trench coats and slinky double-breasted jackets pair with super relaxed trousers. There are suits, of course, but suits for men who stopped working in any traditional sense long before the rest of us. It's the sort of stuff you wear to feel great and look great, all without compromising on either side of the equation. Just as Armani always intended. And there's a number of other photos on this spread. In one shot, the model is just kind of leaning down on the ground on maybe it's a driveway. It's hard to tell, a parking lot. And it looks like it's evening because they're using lights to flash on him. He's got that same kind of taupe suit on, this time with white sneakers. And the pants, though, it's not really a suit, I guess. There's a jacket on top, but the pants are gathered at the bottom. So it looks like kind of like sweatpants of some kind. And then in another photo, he's wearing a t-shirt underneath a suit jacket. And the jacket, trousers, and t-shirt and sunglasses in the first photo are all by Giorgio Armani. The sunglasses are $902. The sneakers are $450 by Zvel. And in another shot, he is seated at a cabana bar out front, and he's wearing a stone or gray colored three-piece double-breasted suit that also has a kind of a sheen to it. There's a kind of a bluish scarf he's got tied loosely around his neck, and a pair of slip-on slippers instead of lace-up shoes. The jacket, trousers, vest, and scarf are all by Giorgio Armani, and the sunglasses are $513. The slides he's wearing, that's not slippers, slides are $195 by APL, and the socks, which are a silvery blue, are by Falk for $42. On the opposite page, the same model is seen cavorting in a number of outfits here. He's got, in each case, a beanie on his head. In the first shot, he's got a bluish, could be a blue seersucker suit jacket or sport coat, I guess, over a half-zip navy sweater and a pair of stone-colored or very almost off-white pants and a pair of white slides, and he's jumping off a wall. In the next shot, he's on a beach wearing a taupe jacket and pants, and it's hard to tell, but it looks like either the jacket he turned up the collar or it's collarless. But it's got three buttons on the front, and he's got a scarf on. And in the last shot, he's wearing possibly the same outfit It's just that the colors are a little bit different. This one's almost like a grayish gray or greenish gray. And he's just sitting on the beach. The jacket, trousers, shirt, and pocket square, oh, in the first shot, are all by Giorgio Armani, and the slides are $195 by APL. And then in the inset shots, the jacket, trousers, and scarf are by Giorgio Armani. No price given. Because they're priceless. That was a joke. The next up, feature. Rev. To one America, he has long been a beacon of the civil rights movement. The man met Dr. King. To another, he was a loudmouth in a tracksuit, surrounded by controversy and shady friends. The man knows Don King, too. Pulitzer Prize winner Mitchell S. Jackson tailed Al Sharpton around the country to find out why he keeps going, what he's still doing, and where his place in history will be. And on the opening spread, there are a couple black and white photos of Al Sharpton, Reverend Al Sharpton, standing in a very nice, single-breasted, grayish suit with a wide striped shirt and a solid tie with the initials RAS on that tie. And that caption says, Sharpton outside the National Action Network in Harlem. Deep into a long career as a civil rights leader, mentored by some of its most revered figures, though controversial himself, he is now the movement's elder statesman. Washington, D.C., August 26, 2023. Can't tell you what Martin Luther King Jr. was doing in the hours, minutes before he delivered his I Have a Dream speech, but I can tell you that 60 years later, Alfred Charles Sharpton Jr. is sitting in an upholstered wooden chair in his trailer, parked on a fence line behind the Lincoln Memorial, fielding calls on his cell phone about today's rally, at which he will deliver his own speech. Can't tell you the logistical concerns MLK solved himself in the minutes before he gave his most famous public address, but I can tell you that Sharpton's cell is ring, ring, ringing, with handlers and schedulers panicked about the lineup, about having the event shut down by the National Park Service for the bureaucratic alibi that it has run past its permitted time. On the umpteenth such call, Sharpton, who's about as calm as an August breeze, tells the anxious messenger to get a hold of Stephen K. Benjamin, a senior advisor to President Biden, and have him handle it. There were 250,000 people at the original March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, but today's continuation, that's what he's calling it, a continuation, not a commemoration, appears not to reach the 75,000 estimated by Sharpton and Martin Luther King III, two of its chief organizers. Still, King is present with his wife and their daughter, MLK's only grandchild. And Sharpton? Coretta Scott King herself once described him as a leader, quote, in the spirit and tradition of Martin Luther King Jr., unquote. Nonetheless, over his long career as a rabble-rouser, there have been no few folks naysaying how well he has bent the moral arc of the universe toward justice, who have questioned whether he's deserving of inclusion on the esteemed shortlist of civil rights icons. The trailer has a kitchen, bottled waters and half-dirty dishes scattered across its countertop. A dining table holds Sharpton's briefcase and a bottle of his trusty Cool Mint Listerine. He swishes it as a habit to preserve his voice, which is tinged with natural rasp. Against a wall of fake bricks, one of the world's tiniest flat-screen TVs and a gas fireplace. Sharpton wears a blue three-piece suit with a blue and white striped tie, a uniform of empowered men from a certain era, of his era. The man is 69 years old. He wears black Oxfords that have the comfortable soles of sneakers, and the shoes aren't new, proven by the white threads peeking around their top lines. Sharpton's cell keeps on ringing. Amid the fusillade of frantic calls, one turns out to be not from a worried handler, but from the Reverend Jesse Jackson. He who was here to witness up close the original I Have a Dream 60 years ago, he who made two serious runs for the presidency of the United States, he who is an incontrovertible civil rights titan. Reverend, Sharpton says, a warm smile in his voice. Jackson responds, but Sharpton, who most people call Rev and diehards proclaim as the president of Black America, can't hear him, so he puts the call on speaker. I'll come see you, Reverend, Sharpton says. Jackson's health has been deteriorating, and he sounds to my ear unintelligible. But Sharpton, who speaks to his mentor on the regular, deciphers it. What are the chances it would be Jackson calling right now? Jackson, who worked side by side with MLK. Jackson, who met Sharpton when he was a teen and helped nurture him into a leader. Jackson's garbled voice in this trailer is a bridge to a long-gone past, from MLK's admired activism to Sharpton's much-criticized methods. Don't worry about that, Sharpton is saying to Jackson. I'm going out there. I'm speaking for you. You trained me to do it, and I'm going to do it. Don't worry about it, Reverend. I'll call you as soon as it's over. Sharpton hangs up his phone and says, that was an omen. South Carolina, 3 weeks earlier. There may be no greater marker of evolution than the posterity of the once enslaved traveling by private jet to visit an old plantation. Sharpton has chartered one to see the South Carolina property on which his forebears worked as chattel. The entourage includes about a dozen folks, counting Sharpton's security detail, his personal photographer, and members of his communications team. The most meaningful travelers today are his daughters, Ashley, 36, and Dominique, 37, who, because neither has visited, were the motivation for the trip. A small delegation, local historians, folks whose ancestors were enslaved with Sharptons, receives him at an airport in South Carolina. We caravan in black SUVs, Sharpton doesn't drive, to what used to be a plantation called Cactus Hedge. In 2007, Sharpton learned from a genealogist that his great-grandfather, Coleman Sharpton Sr., was enslaved by pre-Civil War plantation owner Alexander Sharpton, a man who once owned more than 4,000 acres of farmland and enslaved 78 people, and that Alexander purchased Coleman for $276 in 1839. Sharpton also discovered that his great-grandfather was later enslaved by a relative of Strom Thurmond, the longtime South Carolina senator and staunch segregationist. Old trucks, rusted to the color of day, squat in a field. A fence of chicken wire surrounds the main house. You can hear chickens clucking, a pen of turkeys gobbling and yelping, sea goats wandering. There's a pit of rocks and twigs for a bonfire. The man who now owns the property, Philip White, tells Sharpton that he bought it because he loved it and it was cheap. He says he paid $50,000 for the house and 10 acres in 1983. White is squat with a neck that doesn't move much. He tours us through his two-story main house, large for its time at around 2,000 square feet. He acknowledges the children's toys scattered about the living room. He points out the breezeway, explains how the house stays cool because of the gaps in the wood flooring. He points to the thickness of the beams running across the ceiling and brags that they were hewn from heart pine. He shares that he didn't know the history of the house when he bought it, but that it was perfect, just like it was 100 years ago, he says. No one reminds White that the idyllic life of 100 years yore was smack in the crush of Jim Crow, an era when Sharpton or me could have been lynched for looking him in the eye or refusing to kowtow off his side of the street. White tours us across a large field. A Kangal shepherd dog the size of a dinosaur, 150 pounds if he's an ounce, that White swears is harmless, bounding alongside us, to a shack that would have housed Sharpton's great-grandfather and many others enslaved on the plantation. The shack, which is the size of a two-car garage, is made of rotting wood and has a rusted tin roof and a chimney of rock and mud. Sharpton stands in the doorway. This is where they would have to eat, a question and statement in one. Exactly, says White. Sharpton calls his daughters over, and they all stand near the front door, gazing around the room. They take a photo at the threshold. It's a striking photo. There's no way to ignore the sorrow in their eyes. White explains more about the daily life of the black people who lived on the plantation. They had cows, beef, they had a big garden, so they ate good when they lived here, he says, sounding earnest. But they were slaves, Sharpton shoots back. The enslaved were not given headstones, but there's a strong chance that some of Sharpton's relatives are buried in unmarked graves beneath a nearby gravel area. Soon, we're trundling along Sharpton Road on the way to the cemetery where Sharptons are buried, White Sharptons. Al Sharpton is ensconced in the SUV again, a soft briefcase stitched with the insignia of the National Action Network, NAN, his organization. Beside him. His cologne, Al Haramain's amber oud, fragranting the cabin. He wears a silver Rolex and a diamond insignia ring with his initials. Up close, his hands are a shade or two lighter than his face. He keeps his nails trimmed short. Sharpton, Ashley, and Dominique stroll the Bermuda grass between the headstones to a row where Alexander and Adeline Bussy Sharpton lie. Sharpton holds his phone in one hand and keeps his jacket buttoned. He and his daughters look over more headstones, some of which are large and dressed with fresh plants and bouquets, some of which belong to Thurmans. It is one thing to be black and know that, generations ago, white people owned your forebears. It is quite another to be standing at the foot of the gravestones of those white people and their posterity and considering that the surname that's become a crucial part of who you are is theirs. And that's the feeling I see wash over Ashley and Dominique. On the private flight back, the captain offers snacks, which Sharpton declines. His ascetic diet consists of one meal a day: kale salad, boiled eggs, tomatoes, and cucumbers. Sometimes he has a green juice in the morning. Sometimes he snacks on a piece of dry toast. Matter of fact, over the 2+ months I spend with him, I don't see the man eat a single meal. This version of Sharpton is svelte, polished, measured, wears bespoke suits, and has the bearing of a statesman. Harlem, June 10th, 2023. Every Saturday, clockwork, Sharpton can be found at the Harlem headquarters of NAN, a building long ago christened the House of Justice by Jesse Jackson, holding his Saturday action rally. There's not much difference between the House of Justice and a storefront church, right down to its location smack between a Kennedy chicken and biscuit and a bodega, to the graffiti tagging its weathered face, to the speaker just above the threshold blasting the goings-on inside. There ain't much difference either between the rally and who you'd find at an eclectic, non-denominational black church service. A little girl in a white dress holding a NAN fan. A guy in the front row shooting the happenings on a pair of cell phones, one in each hand. A woman wearing a gay pride sash. She was at the Stonewall riots in 1969. Dark sunglasses and a tiara. All of them sitting in padded interlocked chairs, save a man capping an aisle in a wheelchair. Along one wall, a three-piece band. Drums, guitar, keyboard, plays stirring gospel. The choir sings in front of the pulpit, a low wooden platform with a simple branded podium. Those blue walls of the House of Justice are a gallery. Above the band, there's a giant framed photo of Sharpton with James Brown, maybe the most important man in his life. There are photos of Sharpton with President Barack Obama, with President Biden, with former Attorney General Eric Holder. Him consoling the mother of Sean Bell, shot to death by the NYPD on his wedding day in 2006. There are framed clippings of Sharpton from the New York Times, the Amsterdam News, the New York Daily News, the cover of Newsweek, a blown-up version of him on the cover of Ebony. Dominique, as well as Sharpton's ex-wife and the mother of his daughters, Kathy Jordan, joins the choir to sing Never Give Up, which rouses the room to its feet. During a long pause in the song, Sharpton strolls out wearing a dark gray suit, a striped tie, and black dress shoes. He takes the lectern and gazes at the room. No justice, says Sharpton. No peace, says the audience. No justice, says Sharpton. No peace, says the audience. No justice. No peace. What do we want? Justice, shouts the audience. What do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now. Fist bump the person next to you and tell them you love them, he says. Sharpton begins his sermon by discussing the history of civil rights, half-joking about fly-by-night protesters who say, I ain't gonna take no more, and then at the next instant can't be found. The crowd laughs. I want young folk that will be here for the long haul, Sharpton says, that understand that this is not a seasonal struggle. And the reason I know that is that I was raised by those who understand this was going to be a long struggle. I was young, wild, crazy, and mad as anybody else. I understand all that. But after a while, you understand that you got to deal with pacing yourself for the long haul. The rally will include a red pantsuited, red-wigged, red-lipsticked woman praise dancing in bare feet. The NAN Freedom Runner, a dude in an orange t-shirt and dark aviator sunglasses, dashing laps around the floor to people cheering, Run, Jesse, run! Run for our freedom! Will include Sharpton standing on the edge of the platform to collect tithes and calling both the name of the person and the amount of their offering. All right, I need some 50s. 50s, 50s, come on, he goads after the first few $100 or better donations. These people, most of whom must be as distant from the citadels as one gets, are Sharpton's flock, the core of his constituency, too. The ones he can call up and, quick fast, get them raising signs and shouting outside a building or somebody's home. In the 1980s and 90s, Sharpton was a fried chicken gorging behemoth of a man, seen all around New York in a tracksuit, a medallion, a bouffant conch, and big mutton chops as he bullhorned protestations of racism and bigotry and injustice, using a hell of a lot of language MLK wouldn't have dared utter in public. The N-word, cracker, Uncle Tom, analogizing a New York attorney general to Hitler. In his time as a national figure, he's been exposed as an FBI informant. Quote, in my own mind, I was not an informant. I was cooperating with investigations, he told reporters. Been reported by the New York Times to owe millions in personal and business taxes combined. He called the story, quote unquote, misleading. Pleaded guilty to failing to file a state personal income tax return. Been alleged to have been several months in arrears on rent. He was indicted and acquitted on 67 counts of fraud and larceny. Indicted for and acquitted of stealing $250,000 from an organization he founded. He's been labeled the Minister of Hate, a, quote, practitioner of the big lie, unquote, and a, quote, race racketeer, unquote. Been called an ambulance chaser, a loudmouth, a walking soundbite, a media hound, a charlatan, a buffoon, a fake, damn near everything but, as we say, a child of God. Only he was a child of God, and a precocious one at that. Even before he attended kindergarten, Sharpton preached for his church, sermonizing on the Gospel of John from a soapbox placed in front of his church steps because he was too small to be seen in the pulpit. He was 4. By the time he was 7, he'd been christened the Wonder Boy in black church circles. Sharpton's mother steered her wondrous son into the mentorship of Bishop F.D. Washington, who began taking Sharpton all around the country to preach. Sharpton sought out Adam Clayton Powell Jr. on his own accord, and one of the most powerful black men in America at the time became his earliest political mentor. Worried he'd abandon the church for political activism, Sharpton's mother shepherded him to the Reverend Dr. William Jones, who made Sharpton the youth director of the New York chapter of Operation Breadbasket, the economic arm of MLK's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Sharpton soon met the national director of Operation Breadbasket, the young, hip, Reverend Jesse Jackson. Powell, Jones, and Jackson helped mold Sharpton from the Wonder Boy preacher into a wonderkind activist, a boy who founded his first civil rights organization, the National Youth Movement, NYM, with money he'd received from MLK's former close advisor, Bayard Rustin. Sharpton was just 18 in 1973 when he met James Brown, whose son had attended NYM meetings. Brown's son died in a car accident, and to honor him, Brown reached out to Sharpton and performed a fundraising concert for the NYM. Before long, Brown and Sharpton's relationship deepened. Sharpton married one of Brown's former backup singers, Kathy Jordan, and they had Dominique and Ashley. And well, that's where we're going to have to end it this week. We will jump back into this profile of Al Sharpton next week. Until then, this is Jay Stowe, signing off. Have a good one.